Part 1. The Build-Up. Since one requirement of organized crime is that it actually be organized, of course, there would have to be meetings from time to time. The most celebrated such get-together is known to us only because it was a complete fiasco. The 1957 barbecue at Joseph Barbera's Apalachin, New York estate that was crashed by police, sending about 100 mob bosses and their bodyguards fleeing in their fancy Italian loafers through the upstate woods. There were also landmark gatherings in Cleveland in 1928, Havana in 1946, Palermo in 1957, and those are just the ones we know about. But they all pale next to the Atlantic City Conference. By 1929, Prohibition was winding down, and the hoods, who had become rich from illegal alcohol, needed to look into the future and determine their place in it. As legend has it, as many as 30 top gangsters from across the country answered the call. Many of them now household names, men who would someday replace the cowboy gunslinger as iconic American outlaws. All come together to conspire. The mind reels. According to accounts of the conference, it produced something like a manifesto, a written list of bullet points meant to serve as the constitution for an ambitious new nationwide underworld government. There were moments of deadly serious drama, and even a surprise ending. Once the gathering was over, one of the attendees' number, a really famous one, was arrested and sentenced to a year in prison. It wasn't all business, however. There were wild parties and heroic feasts, with fancy ladies provided for everyone who hadn't brought his own. In short, this was nothing like the office meetings you or I have been made to attend. There had always been gangs of criminals, of course, but they didn't require national planning conferences. Starting in the late 19th century, the Mafia and the Black Hand had been imported from Sicily to certain American cities, but their crimes were dreary and lacked finesse. They mostly extorted fellow immigrants and counterfeited money, but so crudely that words on the bills were often misspelled. The criminals, like their victims, were largely illiterate and backward, and had no access to real dough. That changed in 1920, when the Volstead Act went into effect and transformed the economics of lawbreaking. The ban on alcohol was favored by pious Protestants of the Midwest and South, but immigrant Catholics and Jews and other residents of big cities either ignored prohibition, circumvented it, or seized the opportunity it presented. At last, the criminally inclined upstart could make some serious money. But the alcohol boom also brought with it tabloid-quality violence, as bootleggers fought over supply as well as customers. It got particularly nasty in Chicago, to the point where even Capone's hoodlum counterparts in other cities felt that he had gone somewhat overboard, and in doing so, tarnished the good name of all bootleggers. This was the situation leading up to the events of May 1929. The most detailed and oft-quoted account of what happened that week in Atlantic City didn't come to light until 1974, with the publication of The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano, a book by Martin A. Gosch and Richard Hammer. It had an intriguing backstory. Gosch was a Hollywood producer who had met Luciano late in life, while the legendary gangster was living in exile in Italy. For a number of reasons, primarily financial, Luciano decided he wanted to see his story told cinematically, and so the two men spent months together, with the gangster dictating to Gosch, who then wrote a script. Word of this collaboration reached some of Luciano's former colleagues, who were understandably alarmed. As the tale goes, an emissary of Meyer Lansky traveled to Naples and informed Luciano that unless he dropped the movie idea, he and Gosch might both live to regret it, and not for long. In retaliation for this shabby treatment, Luciano instructed Gosch to wait until the gangster had been dead for 10 years and then publish his confessions as a book. They began working together in 1961. A year later, while Luciano and Gosch were walking together through the Naples airport, the gangster collapsed and died in the movie producer's arms. The requisite 10 years passed, at which point Gosch teamed up with an experienced mob reporter, Richard Hammer, who had worked for the New York Times and written a respected book about Lieutenant William Calley and My Lai. Together, they turned Luciano's story into a compelling, dramatic memoir of the former boss of bosses and prime architect of American organized crime. According to the book, the list of hoodlums who came to the Atlantic City Conference reads like a who's who of bootlegging, gambling, and pimping. The big black limousines carrying sinister passengers arrived from all over the country. Capone arrived from Chicago, bringing with him his close ally, Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, the nickname coming from Guzik's astonishing speed in flipping through a stack of bills with a wet thumb and never losing count. King Solomon drove down from Boston. Boo Boo Hoff, Waxy Gordon, and Nig Rosen came up from Philadelphia. From Cleveland came Mo Dalitz and his allies Lou Rothkopf and Charles Polizzi, real name Leo Berkowitz, the adopted son of the mafia-affiliated Polizzi family. A whole delegation of the Purple Gang came from Detroit, doing the bidding of its leader, Abe Bernstein. Boss Tom Pendergast of Kansas City sent a surrogate, John Lazia. Longy Zwillman and Willie Moretti represented New York's Nassau County and northern New Jersey. The largest delegation was from New York City, led by Lucania, Lucky Luciano's real surname. It numbered among its members elder statesman Johnny Torrio, Meyer Lansky and his bride, who was unaware of the real reason for the choice of Atlantic City for a honeymoon, Frank Costello, Murder, Inc. leader Louis Buckalter, better known as Lepke. There were even more, but you get the picture. According to the book, Nucky Johnson had made the necessary arrangements, including reservations at the Breakers, an exclusive hotel that didn't admit Catholics, Jews, or other riffraff. Johnson tried to pass off his guests as WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants from nice families, by reserving the rooms under phony names. But once the hoods began showing up, hotel management saw through the scam and turned them away. Nucky was swiftly informed and saved the day by booking his guests into the President Hotel, which was near his home. The gangsters formed a convoy and began driving to their new digs. But then Capone spotted Nucky in his car and brought the parade to a screeching halt. Luciano recalled,
"Nucky and Al had it out right there in the open. Johnson was about a foot taller than Capone, and both of them had voices like foghorns. I think you could have heard them in Philadelphia, and there wasn't a decent word passed between them. Johnson had a rep for four-letter words that wasn't even invented, and Capone is screaming at me that I made bad arrangements. So Nucky picks Al up under one arm and throws him into his car and yells out, 'All you fuckers follow me!'"
Once they arrived at their new hotel, Capone still wasn't placated. He stormed into the lobby and began ripping pictures off the wall and hurling them at Johnson.
"So everybody got over being mad and concentrated on keeping Al quiet. That's the way our convention started," Luciano said.
There were plenty of wild parties and lavish meals for the mobsters, with favors for the wives or mistresses who had come along, fur capes courtesy of Nucky. But there was important business to be conducted, too. Every morning, Luciano recalled, the delegates would make their way to the boardwalk, and there they would pair off and climb into the town's signature canopied rolling chairs pushed slowly along the promenade by attendants. The men didn't talk serious matters yet, but discussed the weather and other trivia, because, as Luciano explained,
"How the hell could we talk about anything else with them niggas breathing down our necks?"
Then, on a quiet stretch of oceanfront, the men would disembark, remove their shoes and socks, roll up their trouser legs, and walk to the shoreline. There, they could convene in peace and conduct what are known even today as walk-and-talks, conversations held outdoors and on the hoof, making police surveillance difficult. On these odd-looking strolls, imagine on a beach in the middle of May, dozens of barefoot tough guys in expensive suits trying not to get their pants wet, the future course of American organized crime was set, Luciano said. Henceforth, they would allocate shipments of liquor smuggled in from Canada to end the literally cutthroat bidding wars. They would set aside money for the day that Prohibition was repealed, as they knew it would be, so they could transition into legal businesses, possibly even the liquor trade. They also discussed how to develop gambling as a growth industry, but without the competition that had turned bootlegging into such a bloody battlefield. In short, they were creating the framework for a national crime syndicate. Another matter, the subplot of the entire conference, centered on Capone. Luciano and Capone's mentor, Johnny Torrio, convinced Scarface that he needed to accept some legal punishment for the violence back home, even if only symbolic, to take the heat off everybody else. So, a plan was hatched whereby he would go from Atlantic City to Philadelphia, allow himself to be pinched for something relatively minor, gun possession it was determined, and then serve a not too severe prison sentence, which is exactly what happened, though in a suitably mysterious way that will be discussed later on. Another mob legend's account of the meeting, also published after the hood had expired, adds more detail to our understanding of the conference as a landmark event. This book was titled Frank Costello, Prime Minister of the Underworld, written by his longtime lawyer George Wolfe with a collaborator Joseph DeMona, based on 30 years of friendship and conversation between attorney and client. Costello's version of the meeting starts with him and Johnny Torrio sitting together on a bench on the boardwalk in front of the Traymore Hotel. Torrio is reading a slip of paper.
"They're all in," he said to Frank. "Al brought Nitty and Guzik."
He handed the list to Frank, who scanned it. Jesus, if the feds had this list. Last week he had sent invitations all over the country for this convention, and everybody was coming. The roster of names is essentially the same as from the Luciano book, and while this account, also published in 1974, skips over the scene in the hotel lobby, it features many other anecdotes just as lively. This is Costello and Torrio talking privately about the plan to have Capone turn himself in to Philadelphia police. Frank said to Torrio,
"You think Al will go for it?"
"He'll scream," Johnny said.
Frank smiled.
"Anything else except scream?"
Johnny looked across the boardwalk out to sea.
"That ocean is a good dumping ground."
"I heard,"
Frank said. The point of the meeting, Wolfe wrote, was to establish some sort of working relationship between the mobs in control of the various regions of the country, but the hidden reason would be to stop the violence and somehow clamp down on Al Capone, without starting the bloodiest war of all. Wolfe reports Costello's account of meetings held in the President Hotel's conference room with the underworld bosses seated around a long mahogany table illuminated by a crystal chandelier. The Chicago delegation, headed by Capone, is huddled at one end of the table, the New York bosses at the other, cigar smoke clouding the air. Johnny Torrio stands and says,
"The reason we called this meeting is we have to get organized. Everybody's working on his own. We got independent guys muscling in, and that's got to stop. What we need is a combination around the country where everybody in charge of his city is the boss, but we all work with each other."
Torrio then turns to Costello, who rises, and trying his best not to look at Capone, says,
"The reason we got to organize is that we got to put ourselves on a business basis. That's what we're in, a business. We got to stop the kind of thing that's going on in Chicago right now."
At this point, it becomes clear even to Capone that the men in the room plan to rein him in. But still, he listens calmly. Then Costello announces the new rules, which were apparently agreed upon by him and the other men before the meeting began.
"From now on, nobody gets killed without a commission saying so. Johnny and I have a little piece of paper we want to show you. We're going to have a national commission with every family represented, 24 by our count. No boss will be attacked unless the commission says he has to go."
He went on that way for a while, spelling out how the new organization would work, and he ended with the directive that everyone was waiting for. Capone, he announced, would have to serve some jail time to placate the law and allow things in Chicago to cool off. Capone turned to Torrio, his mentor, and said,
"Tell me when I'm supposed to laugh."
Costello replied,
"This ain't a joke, Al. We got too much invested for you to ruin the gravy train."
More tales from inside the conference are found in Johnny Torrio, First of the Gang Lords, a 1970 book by Chicago newspaper man Jack McFall. When Capone is summoned to a suite at the President Hotel, he finds Torrio, Costello, Luciano, Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, and other bosses waiting for him. Tongue flicking his flabby lips, face emitting a feeble grin, voice not quite reaching the firm tone he wanted, Al turned his eyes to Torrio.
"Well, JT, what's on the docket?" "Capone, you're going to jail."
Shock held him rigid for a split second.
"What?"
he roared. Torrio looked at him without expression, and the others in the suite watched dispassionately. His swarthy face splashed with amazement and disbelief. Capone stormed.
"For Christ's sake, you guys must be out of your friggin' minds! You gotta be kidding!"
Striding about, he flung out savagely.
"Let's cut out this crap! Let's get down to business! What the hell is this all about?"
Torrio said tonelessly,
"Our friends wearing the stars need something. You're it."
Wagging his bullet-shaped head incredulously, Capone conversed with himself.
"This can't be! It's nuts! There's something wrong!"
Halting, he jabbed his chest with his thumb.
"Me? Go to jail? Me? I'll die first!"
Torrio nodded.
"Could be. It's up to you."
Capone offers a compromise. He'll hole up in Florida for a year or two and allow Frank Nitti to run Chicago for him. Torrio just shakes his head. Later, McFall reports, Capone is overheard on a telephone saying,
"Have Shuey Malone,"
a police officer of Capone's acquaintance,
"tipped off that I'll be in Philadelphia wearing a gun. Tell him I'll stand for a pinch."
Best-selling author Lawrence Berggreen turned his attentions to Al Capone after writing a biography of Irving Berlin, which sent him into the period both men shared. For Capone, The Man and the Era, published in 1994, Berggreen uncovered a new source of detail about the meeting. A Damon Runyon short story, Dark Dolores, which was, Berggreen wrote, a lightly fictionalized account of the gathering that first appeared in Cosmopolitan magazine, of all places. In Runyon's tale, the Atlantic City Conference is organized by Dave the Dude, a stand-in for the author's pal, Frank Costello. Berggreen wrote, "Runyon's fanciful retelling of the conference glosses over the serious business that was transacted among the racketeers who had assembled in Atlantic City that warm spring weekend." I called Berggreen to discuss the conference, and he said, "The gangsters at this point felt so invulnerable that they could hold press conferences to tell people what was going on. They almost saw themselves as statesmen. It was like a Brecht play, like a scathing critique of capitalism. You had a corrupt police department that was easily bought off, and the federal government at this point wasn't really going after these guys. These gangsters saw themselves as giving people what they wanted, but of course underneath it all was the bloodshed. They saw themselves as getting better at public relations, but actually they were just calling attention to themselves. They announced an agreement," he said. "They were imitating or mimicking the genuine statesmen of their day, but what they were regulating was racetracks and bootlegging and things like that." It was precisely that level of ambition that captured the imagination of so many writers who have been drawn to the conference as the birth of organized crime in America. To Mafia observers, wrote veteran mob chronicler Hank Messick and Bert Goldblatt in The Mobs and the Mafia, The Illustrated History of Organized Crime, that gangsters operating outside the law could make such complex and far-reaching deals, and moreover, get compliance from independent and greedy men scattered over 1,000 miles of coast, was something of a miracle. According to The Bootleggers, The Story of Prohibition by Kenneth Alsop, conflicts and overlapping of interests were settled in an atmosphere of reason and compromise, and Chicago in particular was the subject of revision of territorial rights. The formal non-aggression and mutual aid pact was signed by the barons. Corporation interlocking of operations in liquor supply, brothels, and gambling houses were agreed upon, and Torrio was elected chairman of the board. In his 1971 biography, Capone, John Cobbler noted, "Cutting across all the old ethnic and national divisions, there gathered around the table not only Italians and Sicilians, but also Jews, Irish, and Slavs, more than 30 gangsters in all." That aspect of the gathering was an unspoken challenge to two major organized crime figures who did not attend: the New York mob chief, Joseph "Joe the Boss" Mazzaria, and his Brooklyn rival, Salvatore Maranzano, both Sicilian mafiosi of the old country traditions. Some accounts say they were pointedly not invited. Others say they would have refused to attend any gathering that included not only non-Sicilians like Capone, but also non-Italians like Lansky and the rest. But the Atlantic City Summit, all the versions agree, was meant to eliminate the need for omnipotent mafia bosses and remake organized crime into a more democratic, collaborative industry like any other. It's worth noting that by the end of 1931, both Mazzaria and Maranzano had been murdered, clearing the path for Luciano and the rest. Once you start burrowing into the literature of the Atlantic City Conference, it's hard to stop. I unearthed a 1973 paperback eloquently titled "Mafia" by Fred J. Cook, which reported that the conferees called for a Future Mobsters of America slush fund, meant to further the development of promising young gang members and to guarantee them the education and give them the proper veneer to serve the organization as innocent-appearing frontmen or future executives. And then I progressed to an even more esoteric history of the period, a definitive work of serious scholarship titled "The Origin of Organized Crime in America, The New York City Mafia, 1891 to 1931, by David Critchley. This book was released in the UK by the academic publisher Routledge as part of a series called Routledge's Advances in American History. There, in a discussion of the various writings about the bootlegging era and its effect on criminal enterprises, I came upon this sentence: "As proof of the apparent march towards consolidation and centralization in the booze-supplying segment of organized crime, error-filled versions of a 3 days meeting in May 1929 in Atlantic City were referenced." Uh-oh.